Okay, so now the recording should begin. All right.
That going?
Is it?
I'm not checking out his butt.
all right, there we go. The recording. Okay. In the interest of keeping with the schedule, I guess I will start. First of all, I just want to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be here and to meet some people. Last night, we spent a lot of time hanging out till what, about 3 a.m. at a diner, chatting, talking about different things, so this is fun. I look forward to a few more conversations like that. Let me first give you a disclaimer. I'm a professor of physics, and I study neuroscience as well, but I am not a theologian. I am not a philosopher. So what I'm going to try to do is basically give you my view from being inside the research lab and being a Christian. And what I see is the science of neuroscience is pushing things in a very particular direction, as John Oakes already alluded to, that is cutting against the grain of Christian worldview. And I'd like to point out where that comes from and how people in neuroscience think about that, and maybe offer some suggestions about how we might be able to think about that. So let's get going here. Worldviews in modern neuroscience. I will focus primarily on the issue of free will. There's so many topics within neuroscience, consciousness, morality, the concept of God. Is that just an illusion? Is it just sort of an electrical activity pattern in the brain? Many things I could talk about. And so to cut that down, really, and just focus on something, I've chosen free will. So here's how I'm going to structure the talk. First, I'll talk about this issue of criminal minds, the idea of moral responsibility, committing wrong acts freely, and then we'll pop the hood, so to speak. We'll look inside and see what's going on inside the brain from a scientific point of view. What can we know about actions composed of neurons sending action potentials? And then I will present the experiments that people in neuroscience use to argue that there is no such thing as free will. So that's the part that says trapped against your will. And then lastly, escape from reductionism. So you're trapped and you want to get out, right? So we'll talk about ways that we can escape from this particular worldview that is very prevalent in neuroscience right now. Okay, criminal minds. Well, great place to start is the Bible. And a great person to start with is Paul. Paul appreciated the idea of choice. And so here's one of his famous passages. He is the guy in the background there witnessing the stoning of Stephen. I want to do the things that are good, but I do not or cannot do them. For I do not do the good things I want to do, but I do the bad, evil things I do not want to do. So if I do things I do not want to do, then I am not the one doing them. It is sin living in me that does these things. Romans 7. So he really has this dilemma of, thank you very much, Shannon. I really appreciate it. The problem of staying up till 3 a.m. last night. Paul has this dilemma. He appreciates that there's good and evil and that we can choose between them. And in this passage, he even alludes to this idea that sometimes it's not even him who's doing it. There's different components of his self that are kind of fighting back and forth against him. So this is something we'll pick up a little bit later, but I just want to point out that within the Bible, we definitely have the idea of moral responsibility. Here's sort of a neuroscientific point of view, though. So this is from a text that talks about neuroscience and the law. And here's a particular case of a person who had a tumor in their right orbital frontal cortex. Let me read the passage here. The neurology literature contains a case report of an unidentified 40-year-old male who developed an increasing interest in child pornography and was eventually convicted of sexually molesting his stepdaughter. The trial judge ordered the patient to undergo inpatient rehabilitation in a program for sexual offenders or face incarceration. However, the patient was unable to restrain his sexual impulses while in the program and was ejected. The evening before his prison sentence was to begin, the patient was transported to a medical center with a headache. A neurology consultation revealed multiple focal neurologic signs. MRI revealed an enhancing anterior fossa skull-based mass that displaced the right orbital frontal lobe. This article goes on to say that what happened is they removed this tumor. The patient's behavior significantly improved for several years, and then he began to recommit some of these acts, and guess what? The tumor was growing again in the same region. All right? So I'm trying to present two very different points of view. The biblical view is we have good and evil before us, and we can choose. the neuroscience point of view is that there's all kinds of physical things that cause you to do what you do. It could be a brain tumor, it could be a set of action potentials in your brain, and certainly we wouldn't be opposed to something like this. This will certainly mitigate someone's guilt, right? If you have a tumor in a part of your brain that controls your moral choices, I think we would probably all say, yeah, okay, that person is perhaps given some sort of dispensation or free pass. So we're not completely opposed to either one of these points of view. The question is, how do we bring them together in a responsible Christian way? Another example of something like this is, maybe you've heard of the Texas sniper, the guy who got up at UT Austin and shot people. Well, he said, I have no idea why I'm doing these things. He kept a very meticulous diary, and it was later revealed that he had a brain tumor as well, in a region that could have probably contributed to malfunctions in his moral choice. So certainly we're not going to throw out the idea that the physical aspect of our brain has nothing to do whatsoever with our choice, but we're also not going to throw out the idea that there is such a thing as good and evil, and that we are given choices between them. And so we can all relate to this, right? So here's a picture of a guy who is a thief, a liar, selfishly ambitious, lustful, unforgiving, ungrateful, unkind, cruel, prideful, abuser of drugs and alcohol, vengeful, and scheming. And I know we're laughing about it, but I really do want to take it seriously. We all are guilty. We all are sinners. There's no point at me standing up here and, you know, I greatly appreciate your talk about integrity. I mean, if I'm going to be a Christian with integrity, I have to admit, I commit moral failure all the time. I make bad choices. And the whole thing about it is that we can say we're sorry and try with our will to be different. So, again, the biblical view, as we all know, is that we have choices. This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life. Deuteronomy 30. Okay, so this is the biblical view. Somehow, how can we preserve it, and what is the onslaught from neuroscience? Okay, to what extent are we responsible for our choices, and can we say that my brain made me do it? Let's get into that a little bit. Okay. And in order to do that, I read a whole bunch of stuff. And again, I'm not a philosopher, but I was reading lots of different definitions of free will. And many of them are very hard to grasp. This is the one that seemed to resonate with me the most, and hopefully it'll be most consistent with a Christian point of view. This is from Raymond Tallis. We must start by characterizing the freedom that we are concerned with. First, if I am truly free, I am the origin of those events I deem to be my actions. Consequently, I am accountable for them. I have ownership of them. I own up to them. Second, they are expressive of me in the sense that they cannot be separated from that which I feel myself to be. In this regard, they are connected with my motives, feelings, and expressed aims. My actions can be made sense of biographically. So there's lots of people who would like to define free will as some tiny little act, like I decide to raise my finger or not raise my finger, or I decide to look left or right or whatever like that. And neuroscientists typically analyze actions that are very small in that way because they're experimentally amenable. You can control them in a lab. But what I would like to argue from the very outset is that the free will that we're talking about is much more deeply related to our personal convictions and our beliefs. And this, unfortunately, is not something that a lot of neuroscientists tend to study. Okay, so I just want to say it's something that is consistent with us. If you're under coercion, if someone puts a gun to your head and says, you know, say you don't love your wife, perhaps you do that and later tell your wife, please understand. But you were under coercion. Is that a free expression of your will? No, it's obviously not. So we're looking for things that are done without coercion, that are expressions of your long-held, consistent beliefs. So this type of definition most consistently says that. And what we'll get into in just a minute is the way in which neuroscientists are trying to probe free will is very remote from this. That's one of the problems. Okay, let's pop the hood and take a look inside. Let's see what goes on. And so now I'm going to give a little bit of background to neurons and the brain and so forth, just to help you understand where we're coming from. So that case of the person who struggled with pornography, he had a tumor in his right orbital frontal cortex. So here's a diagram of the brain, and the frontal lobes tend to be responsible for planning and actions. So in a very rough sense, what you could say is there's this division in the brain right about here, And behind it, most of your brain is devoted to sensory processing. And in front of it, most of your brain is devoted to action. Right in front of this little sulcus, this little division, are parts of the brain that if you stimulate, they'll cause motions in your muscles. So you stimulate it here and there, and you know, you'll get a twitch of your arm or your leg or something like that. If you go a little bit before that, then you'll get patients in the operating room, if you stimulate this, they'll say, I have a desire to move my left arm or my right arm. And if you go even further ahead, then what you'll get are feelings that are like intentions. I would like to plan to write a book. You know, so there's this interesting gradation of action as you go from the central sulcus, which is this part right here, forward. Here are immediate motor actions. Here is preparation for motor actions. And then here it gets progressively more abstract. And even down in here where the tumor was, this is where you might even say things like values are encoded in some sense. There are locations in your brain that if you damage this, your values will be ruined. There's a famous case of a guy named Phineas Gage. He was a railroad worker back in the 1800s, and his job is to tamp dynamite down into a hole, and he used a very thick, long rod. And he was said to be a very pleasant, nice guy, and one day he was tamping dynamite down in with the stick, and the stick, it blew up. And it shot right through his head in a very unusual way. It basically lopped off this part of his brain and almost nothing else. And miraculously, he survived. And so he stumbled back to the camp, and he was talking to people and everything. And ever after that, he was a guy who swore, cursed, couldn't control his sexuality. He just had almost no impulse control at all. And that's consistent with what we know about removing this part of the brain. If you damage this, it's going to have some effect on you. Okay? John?
Just a fun question. Do you think on Judgment Day, God will know those who had little spikes that went into that part of the brain from those who did not?
That's a really good question. I would assume he knows everything. How he weighs that into account,
I
don't know.
If we say that it went up into our brain and it turns out he did, do you think God would maybe call us out on that?
I think he would, yeah. So this is a rough layout of the brain in terms of will and action, where some of these different components of will are attributed to certain structures. So this is just the beginning of it. Now, I should say that there's different components or different scales when you want to talk about the brain. The first scale that you might look at is the neuron. Here's an individual neuron I filled with dye when I was a graduate student. And so we've got 10 to the 10th neurons. Lots and lots of them. And then way up here is the scale of the macro, where we show you something and then a part of your brain in the back, the visual cortex, will light up. So we can talk about global regions of the brain, which we showed in the previous slide, little neurons like this, and then there's also networks of neurons. So now you've got groups of neurons. This is the level at which my lab primarily works, and this is the level at which I'm mostly experienced in. We would call this the meso or middlescopic level. We tend to look at how, 500 neurons send signals back and forth to each other, and how, when they act cooperatively, certain properties emerge from them. These are the types of things that we look at. So there's different scales. Let's go down a little bit and take a look at what neurons are doing, just so we have some basic understanding of this. So these neurons, I represented here a couple in fluorescent green as if I filled them with a dye, they communicate by voltage pulses. So neurons are electrical cells, and they're typically like cocked springs. They're sort of resting at a negative potential, and when they get excited, they sort of pop up, and they go to a positive voltage, and then they come back down and they reset. So when a voltage pulse like this is sent by a neuron, it's like a digital signal. It's like a 1 or a 0. They're almost always exactly the same height and the same width. It sends it down this little axon, which is its outward transmission line, and then it makes a synapse onto another neuron. The synapse is just a place where it can transmit things. I'm sure you've heard some of these words before. And now what a neuron does is it basically sends this signal, a pulse, goes to another neuron, and if that neuron is excited, then it'll send a pulse. Okay, so that's just the basics of how they communicate. There's the synapse circled there. And what people seem to understand in terms of memory is that if we change the connections between your neurons, we change your memories. So let's say, for example, a simple experiment could be, I present a light, and then I give you a cheeseburger. I present a light, and I give you a cheeseburger. A light cheeseburger. I keep doing that again and again and again. And pretty soon, I present the light, and you salivate. Right? This is Pavlov's conditioned reflex. Well, what's going on there? Presumably there's some kind of neural signal that represents the light and some other neural signal that represents the cheeseburger. And each one of those is traveling down a separate axon, forming a synapse. They converge onto one neuron. If both of them excite that neuron repeatedly, those synapses will get stronger. And now, that synapse that conveys the information from the light will be strong enough by itself to generate the salivation response. This is how we generally understand memory. I am whizzing through stuff that would take years of work, okay? So I'm just giving you a very rough picture of what goes on. So synaptic changes are thought to underlie memory. All right, now, how are these neurons connected? They're profusely connected. The average neuron has about 7,000 connections to other neurons in the cortex. Cortex is Latin for bark. That's the outer crinkly covering of our brain, which is perhaps the largest part and also thought to support cognition more than any other part. So 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth inputs, it also makes 10 to the fourth outputs. So each of these neurons has a huge number of connections coming in and a huge number of connections going out. Now, how does a neuron operate? Well, it doesn't just receive a pulse and then transmit it on. It's not merely a transmitting station. What a neuron does is it's a threshold device. So it's sort of a majority thing. If it gets a large number of inputs, then it will cause the voltage of that cell to kind of go up, and then it'll pop off a spike. But if it only receives a few inputs, then it'll kind of go up a little bit, but it won't go over a threshold. So there's a certain threshold for the neuron. And this becomes extremely important when we're going to talk about emergent properties later. This is a threshold device. It is nonlinear. And so it takes sort of a large number of inputs before it will pop something off. Okay? We'll come back to this. All right, so now, what do we do in our lab? So in our lab, what we do is we have a 512 electrode array. This is actually built by our collaborator, a guy named Alan Lipke. His day job is he works at the CERN Collider in Geneva, Switzerland. They've recently found the Higgs boson. I don't know if you heard some of that news. It's the particle that is thought to underlie mass. So he's a particle physicist. And these little devices are basically installed, or things very much like them, are installed in the collider halls where these proton-antiproton collisions are made and then stuff flies off. They pick up the signals with these devices. About 15 years ago, someone convinced them to take one of these silicon strip detectors and modify it so we could record neural activity signals, because neurons produce voltages, like we talked about. So when you take one of these guys and you record from just one of these little dots, this is a tiny wire, what we see is something that looks like noise, and then you have these little vertical tick marks. These vertical tick marks are spikes. These are individual neurons firing their digital signals, ones and zeros. And if we record for 1/10 of a second, this is a little movie of about 1/10 of a second, everywhere you see one of these dots, it's a neuron going off. So these neurons typically only fire an action potential in 1/1000th of a second. So you can get hundreds and hundreds of action potentials within 1 second. So we get huge amounts of data. You might ask, well, wait a minute, what's this thing here that you're placing the electrode array on? This is a brain. This is part of a brain. We remove a section of brain from a rat. We fully anesthetize the rat. We make sure that it doesn't feel any pain, and there is a huge amount of pressure on us to make sure that no pain is felt to the animal at all. There's increasing regulation. It boggles my mind. I mean, you can go down the street and eat a Wendy's hamburger, and no one cares how that was produced. Yeah. But we have to give like pharmaceutical-grade drugs to our rats 5 minutes before they're executed. So, the animal rights activists go way after medical researchers, threaten us with death and things. I mean, one of the guys that I know at UC Santa Cruz, he actually had his house firebombed. And he and his kids had to escape through a second-story window through a ladder. And then they firebombed what they thought was his car, but it was like an anthropology professor's car next door. So they made mistakes. Anyway, there's a huge amount of tension over this, but we do sacrifice animals. This ultimately can help people. I believe that this is a good thing to do. I believe we're learning things. Okay, so this is kind of what we do. We take a look at hundreds of neurons. We're in a position, our lab in particular, is able to look at a larger number of neurons with higher temporal precision than most other labs in the world. And so that's kind of our specialty niche. A lot of people have done work at the large-scale brain level. or at the single neuron level, but we know very little about how groups of hundreds of neurons interact. So this is our thing that we're really trying to hit now over the next 5 to 10 years before someone else comes in and basically eats our lunch with a better electrode array or a better way of recording stuff. So right now we have a niche and we can do stuff. So this is what we're looking at, patterns of activity. Now, when neurons fire like that, one of the very key concepts that I want to get across here is that it's not just random. That little pattern that you saw in the movie looked random. But if you record for a very long period of time and you have statistical techniques for looking at what extracting patterns are, what you will find is that there's lots of organized activities that go on in these sets of neurons. So one of these organized activities is, as I've shown up here, a simple way of illustrating it would be a wave. Okay, so here's a set of neurons, and at one time step it looks like this, at another time step like this, and then this, and then this. So I'm indicating time going from left to right here. And here we have a set of neurons that are on, they're blue, and then one time step later, this little pattern moves to the side. So it's just like a wave that goes through a stadium, right, when everybody stands up and then sits down. It's just like a wave of that sort. That's one type of pattern that we can see. They appear in groups of neurons. Another type of pattern, very simple one, but not one that you want to have, is a seizure. So a seizure is when one small group of neurons basically expands its activity, and then over time, almost all the neurons within a local area are synchronously active. They're all firing at the same time. And this is uncontrollable activity. It's not damped. And that's another pattern that we can see or we can induce, and we can study that. And by studying that, we can actually try to reduce it. But we've actually gotten brain tissue from children who have epilepsy. How do we get human brain tissue? They often remove it if it's next to a tumor. And if they can remove it next to a tumor, we're there catching it in a little beaker. We'll run and put it on our electrode array and record from it. We can find seizure-like activity in tissue removed from humans. We can study how it's originated, how we can stop it, things like that. Another elementary type of pattern that you might see is an oscillation. So an oscillation would be, you know, some set of neurons that are active here, and in the next time step, a complementary population will be active, and then after another time step, it'll go back to that original population, and then yet another time step back to that complementary pattern. So you see alternating patterns of activity going back and forth, back and forth. This type of oscillation is very prevalent when people start to concentrate on something. When you first focus your mind on, let's say I'm going to read this passage, there's certain types of oscillations that quickly develop in the brain. There's another frequency of oscillations that develop right before you go to sleep. There's tons of study. Again, I am massively glossing over huge amounts of literature and just trying to pack it into sort of like, you know, something that's digestible in a few minutes. So the main point I want to get across with this slide is it's not necessarily the individual neuron that tells you anything. It's the pattern of activity in those neurons that can tell us about what the brain is doing. So if I can record from a large population of neurons, you can even tell things like where a rat is in the maze just by looking at the population activity of the neurons. You can tell what a person is thinking by scanning their brain as they sit in a scanner from a set of pictures. Okay, I can't think that you would be able to discern any particular thought, but if you show people a set of, let's say, 10 photos, and you train them on those 10 photos, and now you say to the person, okay, think of one of those photos, you can tell by reading their brain which photo they're looking at pretty reliably, okay? So there is a correspondence between what we are thinking and the pattern of activity in our neurons. And the pathways, the connections between them, the synapses, encode how these patterns will activate, and that encodes memory. So I'm trying to get across the idea that there is a relationship between the physical brain and our thoughts and our memories. Okay, we'll get to will in a few minutes. All right, now, what I want to show you really quickly here is a tool that we use to try to inform our intuition about how groups of neurons can work. So here's a little computer program, and I was talking with Matthew earlier. He's an engineering graduate student. He looked at it. He goes, oh, that's MATLAB, and he got all excited, and he must work with MATLAB a lot. This is a very common simulation tool that people have. Now, what I'm going to tell you about here is what we have is, imagine this is just a patch of brain, this square here, and these blue dots are neurons that are active. They're firing little voltage potentials. Now, what I can do over here in this left side of the screen is I can control how they're coupled to each other, and I can control what the threshold is on the neuron. So these are some properties that we just talked about, their pattern of connectivity and their threshold. Now, if I set it up in such a way like this, and I turn it on, you're just going to see sort of random activity. Nothing really that interesting goes on. Okay? And I meant to make it random, so nothing interesting is going on there. Now, what I want to do is show you that if I slightly change the settings here, and just give me a minute to be able to do this in a way that that's one. Actually, this should be zero. This is one. I'm going to change the settings. Now it's going to have what's called nearest neighbor coupling and not just random coupling. And I have to change some of these, something called the connection density. Oh, whoops. It didn't jump the right way. That one there. Let me click into here. Hello. Okay. 0.95. So don't worry about what these things mean. I'll tell you kind of roughly what they mean in a minute here. Refractory period of 5 and neuron threshold. I'm going to change the neuron threshold to something larger. I made it 4. That means it's got to receive 4 inputs at the same time before it will send an output itself. And then probability of spontaneous, I think, is like 0.02. Okay, now I change the way in which these neurons are connected, and I change the nonlinearity of the neurons. Okay, and I just want to just give you an illustration of what can happen when you do this. And now you see very clear patterns emerge. And this should eventually produce lots of waves. I'll run it one more time. Sometimes it produces spirals. So the only point I want to get across is these types of activity patterns, emergent activity patterns, depend very much on how the neurons are connected and what their activity pattern, their threshold is. Okay. So if these patterns of activity in our brains are representing memories, or representing thoughts or intentions to move or plans to move and things like that, we can govern this by the way in which these guys are connected. That's the main point I want to get across. Okay, so if we pop the hood, we look at neurons interacting collectively, and we look at emergent properties that can pop up in groups of neurons. And these emergent properties can represent things that we typically assign cognitive meaning to, memories, intentions, thoughts, and so forth. Okay. Now, one of the things that our lab has done is we've spent a lot of time looking at emergent properties in groups of neurons. We were co-discoverers of this thing called neuronal avalanches. So it turns out that you can get avalanches of activity in neurons. The same statistics that govern avalanches in piles of sand or snow, you amazingly find the same thing in neurons when they interact. We've also found repeating memory patterns, so you can have patterns of activity that you'll see flit across the screen, and then maybe an hour later you'll see exactly the same pattern, and then 5 hours later you'll see it again, and then 10 hours later you'll see it again. Statistically significant repeating patterns that would not occur by chance. These things might represent some tokens of memory. We also can see waves and spirals, and other people have seen this. So I just want to give you a general idea of the picture here when you look at that scale. Okay, now let's get to the big assault on the Christian worldview by neuroscience. And a lot of these neuroscientists are not mean in their intention. They have just totally bought into the scientific worldview. And they're doing what it leads you to believe. Okay? So here's the most famous experiment that supposedly disproves free will. And almost all the other experiments are variations of this. So this is Benjamin Libet around 1985, somewhere in there. Here's what he did. He said, I want to see whether there's some sort of neural signal for free will. If there's a neural signal for memory or a neural signal for other things, there ought to be a neural signal for free will. So what he did is he gave people a very simple task. He set them down in a chair and he said, look, you can just raise your wrist or your finger whenever you want. You decide. This is going to be your free will task. And then he wanted to measure a few different things. So one, he put an electrode on the person's arm so he could find out when the muscle contracted. So he can find out when the action actually began. And then he put an electrode on the person's brain to see if there's some neural signal that kind of correlated with the movement. And then he asked the person to note the time at which they decided to move. So he had a second hand. It was actually moving faster than seconds, but spinning around a clock with pretty high precision, a person could kind of look at it and go, oh, when it hit the 15, that's when I first decided to move, and then they lift their hand. So there's the person's stated intent of when they're going to move, there's the muscle of when they actually moved, and then there's the brain signal. And I think you know where this is going to lead, okay? So if they're saying that there is no free will, then here's what basically happened. And I guess I'll have to explain with my cursor because I've got two different things here. So D is where the person said they made a decision to move. Okay? A is where they actually started to move. they started to begin to move. But this RP thing is what's called the readiness potential. It is something that was the electrical signal from the brain. They find this thing starting to pick up about 500 milliseconds before the action actually occurs. Okay, that's fine. There's something going on in the brain before you move your muscle. But here's the real paradox. The readiness potential is about 300 milliseconds, or 3/10 of a second, before the person's stated intention to move. Okay, so there's some signal in your brain that starts to go a certain way, and you're sitting there, and then you go, hey, I think I want to move. So neuroscientists have seized upon this to go, aha, there is no such thing as free will. There's just a little signal in your brain that kind of makes you do it. And then you're sitting along for the ride, and you have the perception that you initiated the movement. Isn't that cute? You didn't really do it. You just felt like you did. And then they go into all these evolutionary arguments about why you would survive better if you felt like you were actually in control, even though you weren't. And, you know, it gets interesting from there. But this is the basic structure of the argument about why neuroscientists say there is no free will. There have been literally over 100 replications of this experiment. And it gets even worse. Okay, so here's a more modern version of it, 2008. And basically, they've got information about 8 seconds now. Statistically significant information from the brain signals 8 seconds before the person has the perception of deciding what to do. Now, the neuroscientists take this and they go, oh my gosh, this is it. There's no such thing as free will. Interesting. Okay, so this is the argument. This is the trapped against your will part of my talk. All right. And there's lots of ways of doing this. You can insert electrodes into a person's head. Sometimes people have surgery for epilepsy, and electrodes will be placed in just to monitor certain brain regions. And then you'll find individual neurons spiking before the intention, stated intention to move. Okay. And then people have done variants on this where they've stimulated certain parts of the brain in a subtle way, small enough so that a person can't actually be aware of the stimulation, but enough so that they start to cheat in a game in a statistically significant manner. And so this falls into the mechanistic explanation of your brain is nothing but a bunch of electrical signals just driving your muscles to do certain things. That's all it is. You're just a pack of neurons, okay? And if we can control the electrical signals, we can make you behave in a Machiavellian way. Right? That's what this study was. This is a write-up of it in Science, which is a pretty high-profile magazine. Okay, so to sum up, what the picture is strangely a little bit like what Descartes proposed a long time ago. You have inputs and outputs, and we're just kind of a machine. You might have some sensory input, like a flame at your foot, and you might want to withdraw it, or at your hand, you're touching a hot stove or something like that. But there's also noise, a certain amount of various, you know, random thermal noise that might cause your neurons to fire when they're not supposed to. And this combination of noise that is out of your control, it might be random, but it's certainly not subject to your will, and sensory stimuli, which are just presented to you based on where you are, those things combine to produce an output, and that's it. You're just a machine. That's all you are. Okay, so this is the neuroscience point of view. All right, how many people love this? All right, so it's a pretty nasty view. And what you get are neuroscientists saying things that are just absolutely outrageous. They start to make pronouncements about morality and how, you know, there's a guy named Sam Harris, you've probably heard about him. He's a very famous atheist. So he just wrote a book on free will. And he is an interesting guy. If you go to look at some of the videos he's got on YouTube, he adamantly denies that there's free will. He just keeps going on and on and on. He says, all the neuroscientific evidence, you know, you're an idiot if you believe there's free will. You know, his typical type of diatribe. But then, if you continue to listen, if you haven't turned him off by that time, he goes on to talk about how important it is for us to behave morally. What? I can't believe it. And then it's interesting to see him gyrate and try to twist and turn to try to implore people to behave properly while he's just denied free will. This is strange. So there's all kinds of unresolved paradoxes in
So how did he come to that conclusion?
How does he come to the conclusion that we still ought to behave morally?
No, how does he come to the conclusion that we have free, that we
don't have free will?
By come to the conclusion, I mean someone had to give him a rational argument to convince him, and he had to make a choice to believe it.
Very good. Right, exactly. So this is one of the contradictions.
He's trying to convince us.
It sounds like he wants us to make a decision, right?
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of problems with it.
He's trying to program our neurons, is what he's saying.
Yeah, he wants to rewire our connections. So there's all kinds of stuff with it. So how do we get out of this? What are possible ways out of it? And what I'm going to give you is kind of a survey of different approaches to it that different people have taken, bits of evidence that cause us to pause before we fully embrace this deeply flawed worldview. Okay. So first of all, I'm going to go over what's more or less a common sense rebuttal. Then we'll talk about potential flaws in the Libet type experiments. And then we'll talk about the poverty of reductionism. And I think the poverty of reductionism is the real core problem here. So we'll save that for last. The common sense rebuttal is this. Look at this study. Encouraging a belief in determinism actually increases cheating. And this has been replicated by many different people, okay? So what they do is they take two groups of people, they present them with seemingly authoritative but bogus scientific articles. One article says, it's been proven there's no such thing as free will. So the group of people read these articles, and then they go into some situation, as always in social psychology studies. They're really testing you for something that they don't tell you they're testing you for. They put you in some kind of game, and you play a game with other people and so forth. And then they give another group of people an article that says, science has proven that you do have free will. Well, guess what? It has a massive, statistically significant effect on how people behave. They cheat way more often right after reading articles that say there's no such thing as free will. Okay, this isn't the only group. This is perhaps the most famous paper on this. But, you know, there's more. So here's the abstract. Does moral behavior draw on a belief of free will? Two experiments examined whether inducing participants to believe that human behavior is predetermined would encourage cheating. In experiment one, participants read either text that encouraged a belief in determinism, i.e. the portrayed behavior as the consequence of environmental and genetic factors, or neutral text. Exposure to the deterministic passage increased cheating on a task in which participants could passively allow a flawed computer program to reveal answers to mathematical problems that they had been instructed to solve for themselves. Moreover, increased cheating behavior was mediated by decreased belief in free will. In experiment two, participants who read deterministic statements cheated by overpaying themselves for performance on a cognitive task. Participants who read statements endorsing free will did not. These findings suggest that the debate over free will has societal as well as scientific and theoretical implications. So, one of the atheist philosophers, Daniel Dennett, you might have heard of him, he does not believe in God. He is definitely not in our camp. And yet, he notices this. And he argues that it's not good to tell people that they don't have free will. So he admits that much.
They better shut up.
Right, so it's interesting. But there's more studies. Here's another one. Personal philosophy and personnel achievement. Belief in free will predicts better job performance. Okay, so if you believe in free will, you get rated better by your employers, by your coworkers, things like this. There is a huge literature on this now. There are tens of studies, probably approaching 100. On the effects of what you believe about free will, and it's very consistent literature. If you believe in free will, you behave better. If you don't, you behave worse. Okay? That's an interesting thing. Okay? So just based on that alone, I would call this kind of a common sense argument. Let's stop talking about the fact that there's no free will, because it actually influences things, right? That's one, you know, the practical outcome. That's one way of kind of first pass saying that this is not a good thing. But we don't want to do it just based on that, right? We're not strictly consequence-based. We also want to know what is the truth. So let's talk about potential flaws in this type of experiment. Well, here's an interesting paper that talks about this. So in this paper, these people argue, and I'll unpack it for a minute, that basically the interpretation of the Benjamin Libet type experiments, where the signal precedes your stated desire, the brain signal precedes the stated desire, these experiments are improperly interpreted. And here's the basic argument. Let's go back to the Benjamin Libet experiment here. And you'll recall that there's this thing called the readiness potential that picks up before the person's stated desire. Okay? Now here's what these people say. Whenever people have studied free will, and you look at neural recordings of lots of neurons, what you find is that there's often competing things going on. Let's say you have a task where you might want to reach in and grab something, but there's a certain chance that you're going to get, I don't know, shocked if you do that. There's a certain probability that you might get shocked when you grab this prize. Well, as you might surmise, there's different parts of your brain that are telling you to go do it and to not do it. And what happens is these signals go back and forth, and we feel this as we're going through this type of decision. Well, should I do it now or should I not? I don't know, I'm afraid. I want to get the prize, but I don't want to get shocked. So what people have found out is often there's competing signals going on, and these things will compete over a period of seconds, perhaps even minutes, before a final decision is made. And what happens is that even though these signals are competing, is that things generally tend to build and build and build before a final decision is made. And in that process, the signals will go from one part of the brain to another, before they reach the part that actually triggers the action. So remember, we talked about sort of your values, and then the intention, and then preparation for movement, and then movement itself. These signals kind of travel almost in a wave as you go from the front toward the motor cortex. So it's a gathering thing. The idea of making a decision as we feel it is we weigh evidence, we slowly come to a decision, and then we say, okay, now I've decided. Okay? Well, neural signals go through the same thing. Now, what if you have a threshold? And this threshold is the decision after which the positive evidence outweighs the negative evidence, and you finally make a decision to act. So what if there's a threshold like this, and the readiness potential is the neural signal of your will, but it just hasn't reached decision? When you force a person to say, I have decided, what you're doing is you're thresholding a signal that might internally be a gradually building one. Our will might be actually something that gradually builds. But then you ask somebody, you must make a decision. So the declaration of that is a discrete event. And so let's say you have a threshold like this, the red line. The readiness potential is the substrate of the will. And then what happens is once it crosses that threshold, then you have this black line that's the step function. That step function says, okay, now the person starts to talk. So what you're doing is you're taking a gradual signal and you're just thresholding it. It might be that actually this is your will, but what we're doing is we're calling someone to make a discrete decision that will necessarily have to be delayed. Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? It's my job to unpack it. So if you don't understand, ask a question and I'll see. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So what's going on is this signal here as it gradually builds might actually be your will. Okay, so let's say you're trying to decide what movie to go to, and there's a bunch of movies, and you go, well, I kind of like this one, I sort of like this one, whatever. And so the signal, let's say you want to go to, I don't know, this Avengers movie, which I thought was pretty good. So what happens is you have sort of a building preference for it, and this building preference is actually part of your will. But what we've done is we've put you in a situation where you must make a final decision of buying the ticket. Okay? So when you buy the ticket, that's not the whole story. There were things that preceded that. And those things can be seen in your brain with the electrical signal. Likewise, in the Benjamin Libet experiment, what they asked someone to do was say when they made the decision to move their finger. They could have actually been thinking about it, but hadn't made the final decision yet. And what happens in us is we kind of weigh through things as they build up, and then you finally make this decision. So what's happening is this signal is building, 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 and it won't trigger a statement from you until it gets this big, until it hits a threshold, which is what neurons do. You know, you have a certain amount of voltage that builds, and then the neuron goes through a discrete change, and it's going to say something. So this signal could be actually your will, but the problem is we're only measuring it after you say something. What if we asked you to say, make a statement the first time you even begin to think about the decision? Then you might say something way back here, right? So it's the way we frame the decision. We could even say, only say something after you're absolutely positively certain and you feel really good about it. Well, that might occur way over here, right? I mean, we don't know. It's sort of where you pick this threshold. And just because this is where the person finally made the statement doesn't mean that that's when their will began. Their will could have begun back here. We just don't have access to it because we didn't interrogate the person in that manner. Does that make more sense?
Okay. That could be a delay in cognizance. Basically, you might have, well, the will might occur much earlier, but you might not be a cognizant of your will until a delay.
That could happen, but that's actually part of their argument, is that your cognizance of your will is actually just a sort of a post, something
like
that happens after
observer,
the fact.
Observer.
You're just an observer of your will. You don't really decide your will. John?
Would it be fair to say they designed an experiment to prove what they wanted to prove?
I don't think Libet, it does that. It does have that effect. But I don't think Libet had any particular agenda. I think he was just honestly looking at it. And then what happened after that, I think, is there's a lot of people.
So the interpretation was coming from the worldview, not the.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is solidified. So I remember giving a talk at some place, and they took me out afterwards for dinner, which is the typical thing. And we ended up talking about free will. And the neuroscientists at this particular school were adamant. It was just utterly ridiculous to think there would be anything like free will. And I started asking questions about it and so forth. And they said, well, what if free will is something that we... Do you believe that science doesn't understand everything yet? I mean, what could be known is like this. And what we know right now is like this. And they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, so free will might not be amenable to some of the concepts we have right now. And they just didn't even want to entertain that thought. So I think there's a very strong predisposition to not accept the idea that we might have something like
free will. Culpability is, free will is necessary in culpability.
Absolutely, right.
Like, I don't think that you can extract free will and still have real culpability.
Right, there's no moral responsibility, there's no such thing as sin, there's no need for a savior, obviously, if you have this. Yeah, so absolutely.
Sometimes if you poke at those kind of people that hold those philosophies, they get really upset because it's really easy to tip their apple cart to start asking ridiculous questions like, well, would you blame me if I shot up your house for fun?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, right?
Like, so they're like, what?
It's often good to go directly to the consequences and say,
but you got to force them on the point and answer the question. Like, what does that mean then?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Those are very.
They have
good.
No answers.
Yes. Well, no, they don't.
So it's common sense that we have free will.
From the moral point of view,
yeah.
if we accept by common sense that there is such a thing as right action and wrong action, then yes, the only way that you can assign blame is if you actually have a choice.
But it's a properly basic belief. It's something that everybody understands, and you can, no matter how dyed-in-the-wool materialist the person you're talking to, you can't get them to remove that. Properly basic belief, they'll have a meltdown right in front of you trying to do it. It's like trying to convince a Mormonism that Joseph Smith's a false prophet. They crumble.
Well, I think, yeah, this is an interesting thing to, and probably I should have done that. But that was the first encounter I had of these people, and I didn't know what to do.
You gotta be nice. I mean, if you see sweat, just stop.
Yeah, sure. Another question?
Does that mean each flop of the hand was then basically just a random event? I mean, what do I mean? Or was it a physical reaction? Or how did they define...
The person just was instructed to move their hand up
right.
whenever they wanted, whenever they so chose.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what's the argument then? Because if they didn't decide to flop their hand, it just flops.
Well, supposedly they decided. So what this is, and we'll get to this in a minute when we talk about the poverty of reductionism. What you're doing is you're basically slamming everything down, okay, into this paradigm where you can study it, but it doesn't really have much relevance to should I become a Christian or should I become a Muslim, right? That's a real choice, okay? Whether I lift my hand or whether I tie my shoe, I mean, we've all driven home at night when we're really tired and not known how we got there when we pulled into the driveway, right? There's a lot of stuff your brain can do automatically without much reflection on your moral choices, who you have decided to become as a person. That's why I read the definition of free will at the very beginning. This has almost no ecological relevance to what we would consider free will choices that have moral valence, right? That have some moral value. This has no moral value whatsoever, right? It's got almost nothing to it.
It's not a rational
process. Right, it has nothing to do with reasoning either. Yeah.
I think what the determinist would say is, the thing at part D is an epiphenomena. We think it's real and it's not.
That's exactly what they say.
The real phenomena is the thing at minus 500 milliseconds.
Exactly. That's what the neuroscientists say, is that our decision, our felt decision, it's an epiphenomena. It wasn't the real thing. It was something riding on. Yeah. Yeah, actually, you were first, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then how would something like this apply to that experience at that particular time? You know, for somebody, are they saying like, mm-hmm. you know, talk about our physical movements mm-hmm.
to isolate like that. Yeah, well, I think this is part of the big question, and neuroscience and philosophy and theology, I think somehow we have to come up with a picture of how these things are interrelated. I've got a slide in a minute that talks about different scales and different levels of explanation. At the very lowest level, you've got neurotransmitters. At the very highest level, you've got, you know, beliefs and values. Supposedly, if we're going to come up with an accurate description of things, all of these things need to be seamlessly integrated from one to the next. And that's a huge project. But what I would say for people who are, let's say, coming out of alcohol or one of my graduate students, he has epilepsy, he has seizures, and when he has seizures, he will say or do things that are not typical of him, right? It's not an expression of his values. It's not an expression of who he has decided to become. And one of my criticisms of this is exactly what you were saying. This has very little to do with what we would consider an expression of a person's values. So in the neuroscience literature, what they say is it has no ecological relevance because it's not really something that models free will in a typical real life situation. So, yeah.
I mean, doing this like in a reductionist aspect, I mean, expanding it out, if we truly didn't have the free will, wouldn't, when I was just walking, my arm would just twitch anyway? I mean, and instead of just sitting in that room deciding to switch because
right.
it would act at any point.
That's and a then, good point.
And then thinking like how this would relate to the morality aspect, if you think about Stanford experiments, when you had the
prisoners,
the prisoners and the prison guards, all the students, they were all outstanding moral people, but when they got put in the situation, you know, the guards became aggressive and abusive, and you know, the prisoners became subservient and kind of lost their desire to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that was based on the kind of extrinsic.
Circumstances. Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of shows free will there because they didn't tell the guards, hey, become mean and abusive. They just started to do that on their own.
Sure.
Know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that...
Yeah, well, I think... I don't feel satisfied with what I've learned about this. I mean, I don't know that I've got a really good, consistent rebuttal. All I can say is that I can spot flaws. Again, I'm not a philosopher. I'll get to sort of like my best shot at demolishing your argument in a minute or two. These are just sort of things that other people have brought up. But it's something that I think is a challenge for us because what we saw is increasing numbers of people are not believing in God anymore. I think part of what's causing this undermining is sort of this misinterpretation of science. The thought that somehow science is at war with religion. You know, what is it? What you say? It's not scientists, but it's preachers versus scientists or something. Yeah. What can you say it again, John?
Well, it's not science versus faith. It's scientists versus theologians.
Theologians, right? Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. So it's I think it's something that we have to work out, and hopefully by presenting some of this stuff, you guys can come up with ideas. I'm not a philosopher, but what I can tell you in a couple minutes as I finish up here is I think there's some very good scientific arguments about why their interpretations are very short-sighted. I'll get to that in a minute, but there's lots of questions. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to be clear on one of the definitions. I guess they would argue that you're bringing into determinism.
Yes.
No room. When I think of deterministic, I think of like reproducible for the same.
Right, okay, so...
So, and then I would... If that's the definition, then how do they argue that there is determinism in such a non-linear system?
You can have deterministic chaos, right?
But I mean, it's not the same type of determinism as like adding 1 + 1 always equals 2.
Right. It's not. Okay.
It is in a chaotic system.
Well,
it's still deterministic. It's just the complexity starts to.
It gets harder to predict what's going to happen next, right? It's like predicting the weather. It's almost impossible. It might be a deterministic. Okay, let me step back for a minute because let me just give some definitions so people can kind of join in on this. All right, so there's basically two views in philosophy about the free will debate. One is that free will is somehow compatible with a deterministic universe. Okay, these are called the compatibilists. Right, they say that somehow you can mesh these two things together, that the universe proceeds according to a set of rules deterministically, and yet there is still free will. Those are compatibilists. The incompatibilists, you might guess, are people who say that, no, there's an essential deep conflict between a deterministic view and free will, that these things cannot go together. And so incompatibilists are of two varieties. They're people who believe that there is free will and the universe is not deterministic, or they're people who believe that the universe is deterministic and there's no such thing as free will. That's called hard determinism. Okay? So there's these three different varieties of things. People who say it's incompatible, or it's compatible, and there's no conflict, there's no problem. There is a problem, and you're either a free will advocate or you're a determinism advocate. So most of the neuroscientists fall into hard determinism. They are incompatibilists. They do not believe that free will, our concept of free will, is compatible with a scientific deterministic explanation of the universe or our brains. And so they're totally opposed to a lot of these concepts that we have, and I think it undermines the worldview that we would like to continue to share with people. Almost always, when I talk to someone about, you know, who I am and what I do, they go, well, don't you have a massive conflict with your job and your beliefs? They're just like puzzled at how can I possibly teach physics and believe in God? Like, what a weirdo you are. And I say, wait a minute, where is the conflict? And I ask them, and they go, well, you know, evolution, well, you know, and they go, you know, the Big Bang. The Big Bang is like one of the best pieces of evidence we have, you know, and they just, the common perception, I'd love to see a poll on what people believe in terms of the conflict of science and faith. And so more people believe as science gets better and better and we produce more things with technological power, God's got to be just an artifact, right? So, but I don't know how to resolve it. But anyway, this is sort of a technical way of rebutting the Libet experiment. Yes, you've had your hand up for a long time.
I have another question about the experiment itself.
Yeah. This is when the volitional decision, the person says they've done that. Let me see if I get it right. Control stimulus on this.
My question is about the RPM to the beam. Yeah. Is that scanning the most injured part of the brain, or is that also checking at the motor area?
So it's
when you move your finger, your shoulder muscles sometimes contract a split second before your hand is stabilized.
Ah, okay, I didn't know that.
And it's like when I sit up, I make a decision to sit up with a split second when one muscle group contracts immediately right before I do the movement to stabilize the actual movement. So that's why I was wondering if they were getting those input signals from our part of the brain, by decision whether it's an outside movement that's not being solidly measured.
Yeah.
And if that could possibly.
Yeah, so this is a very good question, which is, are you measuring the right part of the brain that would not produce an artifact? What I can say is, in scanning the literature and looking at all these different papers, they've been very careful to make sure that it's not just a simple delay artifact. They've looked at many different locations. They sometimes do it left and right, and if you're going to raise, you know, your left hand, then the opposite side of your brain is the one that shows this readiness potential, as it should be. So they've done a lot of work on that. I can't tell you what the details are. All I can say is that in scanning the literature, it looks like they've done their homework. I don't think that's the problem, because that's been one of the consistent objections, and I think they've answered that. I think this is a relatively new objection, because if we go back here, this paper came out in 2013, July 2013, so just about, you know, 2 years ago. So it's relatively recent. I don't know what the response is to this yet. It'll be interesting. So, okay. So here's my final attempt to rebut this, and the poverty of reductionism. So, why is precedence given to the small scale? So let's just talk for a second about the scientific method and how we know it works. What people typically do is they have two groups. They've got a control group. They give them a placebo. And they've got the experimental group. And they give them some pill that affects serotonin. Okay? These people have something that manipulates a molecule in their brain. It's at a very, very small scale. And these people have something that presumably doesn't manipulate a molecule in their brain. And then after 6 months, these people are not depressed, and these people are still depressed. Therefore, your mood is determined by a little chemical called serotonin. Okay? Experiments tend to be focused on one cause. You want to isolate that one thing, separate it from all other things that are interacting. We don't want to look at interactions. We just want to look at one thing that we can control very easily as experimenters. We can increase your serotonin or decrease your serotonin. I can't very well control the pattern of activity in your brain, so we won't do experiments on that. We'll just do experiments on this little molecule. Okay, So we get results. And the results say that this little molecule will, in fact, affect your mood. Okay, does that mean that mood is nothing but a little molecule? Of course not. It's limited by the way we did the experiment, right? We don't have tools that can alter the pattern of activity in your brain, which is really what would change your memories or your thoughts and so forth, or not good tools to alter the patterns of activity. So it's kind of like the drunk looking for his keys under the street lamp. He looks there because that's the only place he can see. But the keys could be over there, right? You've heard that analogy before. Science is very, very limited in the way it does things. It is wedded to this scientific method that manipulates one variable at a time, and usually it picks something that's very, very tiny because it's easy for the experimenter to control. So let me give you a couple of my favorite things in physics to sort of pick on. So here's J.J. Thompson, who was involved in discovering the charge-to-mass ratio of the electron, and what he said after discovering the electron and its properties, he said, the rest is just chemistry. I discovered the electron. This is really fundamental. Everything else is just stupid stuff about how it's combined. That's for other people to figure out. I've done the most fundamental thing because everything has electrons in it. Okay? This is a really rude picture of the physicist's bias toward reductionism. Okay? Really silly behavior because, let's just continue with electrons. If you go a little bit later in electrons, Leon Cooper and colleagues discovered something called, well, they had a theory for superconductivity. This is the ability to conduct electricity through something without any resistance at all. Okay, how does it work? It works on something called Cooper pairs. So a pair of electrons traveling together through a lattice will do this. Okay, as this electron travels through, negative attracts positive. So these positive charges in the lattice kind of pinch together. As they pinch together, they create a higher density of positive charge, which will then attract this electron to come through. They kind of set each other up. And they do that in such a way so that these electrons can pass through a lattice of a certain material without any resistance at all. It's an emergent property of now two electrons. The way those two interact produces this dramatically different thing. You know, you're passing current through something, you're wasting tons of energy, it's giving off heat and light and everything, and suddenly when you have this type of material, electricity passes through, no resistance at all. Dramatic difference based on the cooperation of just two little things. Just two. Okay, but let's go on with electrons and bashing J.J. Thompson. So, what about transistors or diodes? Okay, the way transistors and diodes work is in one area, you have some material and it's got electrons in it. These are these little negative charges. But then it's got something over here, which we'll call a hole. What is a hole? A hole is not really a physical object. What a hole is it's a local depletion of electrons. It's lacking electrons there. So what is it like? It's like a positive charge. It's the absence of electrons. So you can imagine a whole bunch of electrons all over the place, and there you have an absence of them. If the electrons go this way, the hole goes that way. This is an emergent property of electrons, large groups of electrons that cooperate in certain ways that we can control, and it allows diodes and transistors and computer switches and all the stuff that we use in our modern day technology information age. So the rest is just chemistry. Each of these things was a Nobel Prize. So there's a famous article by this guy, Philip Anderson. He says, more is different. Philip Anderson was a Nobel Prize winning physicist who was basically arguing that it is not all about reductionism. It's not about the smallest thing. It's not about the most fundamental thing. At different levels, you have different emergent properties that each of which is a massive undertaking to understand. In and of itself, understanding that level is a major project. The mind is not just one or two neurons firing. It's all in the interactions and the patterns of how they fire. We don't understand that yet, okay? So if we understand how one neuron fires or how one little potential begins to rise or something like that, we are a long way from grasping how these things interact to produce these higher order concepts. This is just a simple example from physics and electrons, okay? So, why are non-material causes considered to be not important? Here's another bias of reductionism. Reductionism constantly goes for the material thing. It's the molecule of serotonin, or it's the gene. Here's a really amazing paper they had years ago. They found a family, I think it was in Scotland or something like that, who had speech difficulties, and they found a gene that was deficient in them. And what they did is they then went into mice and they, expressed this gene and showed certain cognitive deficits. They had a paper in Nature that basically said, the gene for speech has been found. well, this is just unbelievably reductionist. If I take that gene now and I inject it into a mouse, can I have a conversation with that mouse? No. It was necessary for speech. It was an important thing, and it'll mess up your cognition if you inject or deplete that gene from a mouse. But speech is obviously a higher order thing that involves lots and lots of interactions at higher scales. That's where I'm going with this. Okay, so why are non-material causes considered less important? Let me give you a simple analogy. So the wave in a stadium, right? You get all these people together, people stand up, and then they sit down, and they stand up, and you see it go around. You can map the wave, you can see what its size is, you can see what its speed is, you can see its properties. One time I was in a stadium at Notre Dame, and I saw it kind of like reflect at one spot when I think it hit the alumni section, and then it kind of bounced back. So there's all kinds of emergent properties of the wave. It's caused by people interacting, right? I could not understand the wave by taking one Notre Dame student, sitting him in a chair, and saying, stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down. I might have a guess, but I wouldn't really know all these things about the wave. So here's my question for you. What is the mass of the wave? It doesn't have any mass. People have mass, but what about the mass of the wave? The wave is the pattern of interaction. It is massless, okay? And yet that massless thing acts on things that have mass. It causes you to stand up. It causes you to sit down. So you know where I'm going with this. The pattern of interactions of your neurons is a massless thing. The soul is a massless thing, right? But it can have drastic effects on things downward, okay? Causality does not just go from the molecule up to the brain. It also goes from these things that are emergent properties that I would say will is one of them, acting all the way down. Okay, causality goes in both directions, but scientists often don't see that if they're pure reductionists.
Yeah, that goes along very closely with materialists. Materialists would see that as an abstraction that doesn't even exist. Like the mass, the wave is not a thing. Does not have ontological status. Like it doesn't exist. Is what they would say.
Well, that would be a radical stance. Yeah. But if you take that stance, then you would also say that Cooper pairs don't exist. That holes don't exist, that transistors don't work, that superconductivity doesn't exist. That's an untenable position. Okay, and I would argue, yeah, and I agree with you. It's untenable likewise in neuroscience to say that we don't have a will, that we don't have, you know, this or that. And that's exactly where I'm going with it. I think if you really sit down and think about it, there's precedent for this type of thing, and if we extend it, it will demolish this idea that it's merely a reductionist thing. So here's kind of like what you were saying earlier. This is a quote by Haldane. This is actually taken from a lecture by William Newsom. William Newsom is a scientist at Stanford, and he is one of the co-directors of the Human Brain Mapping Project. He is also a believer. It's really interesting. He's written articles, and I sent him an email and talked with him and by email about different things. So he gave a lecture. You can find it on YouTube. I'll give you guys the slides. You can look him up. And he has done an amazing job on talking about free will. He's got lots of insights. But this is one of his favorite quotes by this guy. So Haldane was a biologist many years ago. If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of the atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms.
Yeah.
It undermines itself. Okay. So what you're doing is you're basically giving such precedent to the lowest level thing, the atom, the tiny little thing that you can control and manipulate in your experiment, you believe that that's the only real thing, and that emergent properties of things interacting, that's not real. Superconductivity doesn't exist, you know. The soul doesn't exist. Will doesn't exist, okay? This is the problem. I think this is the fundamental problem. Science has a bias in it, and this bias is beginning to be noticed by people who are not just Christians. Okay, so here's the idea. Causality actually works in multiple directions. So you have neurons which somehow activate groups of neurons which somehow cause patterns in the brain which cause beliefs and so forth, but it actually goes the other way too, right? And if I'm to expand this, I'll make it really big, it looks something like this. So your brain somehow encodes past experiences are interacting with your beliefs. You know, one belief might be, for example, was I abused or was I not abused by somebody, right? That belief is often settled upon by a person reflecting on their past, right? You know, so that's an example of a simple thing that might happen. What you value, am I going to forgive or will I not forgive? That's another thing that interacts. These are not just make-believe things. I just think science hasn't gotten there yet. I don't know what the pattern of activation in your brain would be to represent values. I don't know what it would be for will. Okay? All I'm doing is just sort of sketching out a rough pattern for how this reductionist picture can be undermined. And like I said, we're not the only ones who undermine it. Here's a very interesting book, Thomas Nagel. He is an atheist. He's a highly respected philosopher, was loved by many until he came out with this book. This book called Mind and Cosmos. And the subtitle of it is, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. He says that he does not want a theistic conception. Okay? He admits it. He's open. He's an honest guy. He says, look, I don't like religion. I don't want to have that because it creates certain gaps in our understanding and so forth. That's his point of view on it. But here's what he says about consciousness, cognition, and value. Our current scientific system has no way of explaining those things. And so he charts out some of the different possibilities. He says, well, it could be that there's something that is not physical, that there's some kind of mental stuff, and it's present in everything. This is a point of view called panpsychism.
Oh, it's not just dualism?
No, he talks about dualism, but one of the he's accepting something called neutral monism. That's what he thinks is most likely. But the basic idea is that just like atoms have the potential to form molecules, which have the potential to form organisms and life and so forth, he says that potential is there from the very beginning. Okay? But it might not be realized unless there's some kind of what he calls a teleological principle at work. Teleology driving towards some purpose. Okay? He's getting real close to the idea of God. Even though he doesn't like God, he wants God. Okay, so he's talking about things like a teleology that would guide how these things assemble. He would say they don't have to assemble this way, but they did. And we have to explain why they assembled in this particular way.
I think he passed away, though.
Thomas Nagel?
I think so.
Oh, he might have. Well, this book is fairly recent. I mean, it's...
Yeah, he passed away fairly recently.
Oh, he did? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because Bill Craig was talking about this book.
Okay.
And then shortly after he passed. I'll check.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I actually wanted to send him an email. But this book is amazing, and it's got a lot of food for thought. I was reading it again the second time on my way here, but I think I need to read it probably 5 or 6 times to really grasp what he's saying. Yeah?
One way I like to think about the brain is you can look at it from a determinist perspective, you can look at it from a Christian perspective, and the Christian would say the brain is a God-experiencing device, mm-hmm. or a relationship-experiencing device. And if you think about how the brain functions, and if you look at it from that point of view, I think it just starts to make a lot more sense about everything that we know about the brain. Of course, we're going to learn a lot more about the brain, but I would predict that as we learn more and more about the brain, we'll see that it's more and more consistent with this idea that the brain is designed in order to experience love and compassion and connection and these kinds of things.
Oh, yeah. I would totally agree with that. But you know they have tried to knock that down, too. So just let me mention there.
Of course they've tried to knock
that. So here's one of the experiments that they did is they were able to stimulate people in a certain region of their brain magnetically through the skull. And then when people have that, they have some sort of, you know, experience of a spirit being near them.
Right, but that's proving my point.
Right. So what they say is, therefore, the experience of God is nothing but a set of electrical
impulses.
Right,
but I believe what I just said, that's proving exactly God.
Well, right. We're receptive to signals that cause us to naturally think. I mean, yeah, the rebuttal is one that I thought of is, if I stimulate the back of my head here where the visual cortex is and I see a vision of my wife by some random firing of my neurons, does that therefore now mean that my wife is fictitious? No, obviously not, right? And you know this, and I'm just stating it so that we can all kind of see these things. So they quickly jump from the data to some kind of philosophical or worldview statement that the public just swallows whole. And this keeps happening. It keeps happening. Another really awful example is they were doing brain scans of people faced with this moral choice. So you're in a room with, like, say, 20 people, and let's say some soldiers are coming, and they want to kill you guys if they find that you're hiding. And there's a baby, and the baby's crying. And they pose this question. Do you suffocate the baby and so save everyone in the room, or do you let the baby cry and let what happened will happen? So what they found is there's two different groups of people. Some people are utilitarians, and they would suffocate the baby. Other people are deontologists. They would let the baby live and let what happens. It turns out that there's different brain activity patterns for these different types of people. So the utilitarian pattern, the baby suffocating pattern, occurs in the prefrontal cortex, and the let the baby live pattern occurs in the limbic system, which is a more primitive part of the brain that's been around a longer time. So here's what they argue. They argue the prefrontal cortex evolved more recently, so it is the better choice, so it's what we should do. We should listen to our prefrontal cortex and not our limbic system. They're making moral pronouncements and they're telling people what to do based on their interpretation, their extremely impoverished interpretation.
That's a fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. To make some moral conclusion based on something that is.
Yeah, it's not what ought.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't get is.
Yes.
You can't get an ought from this.
Right. And so this is the kind of stuff, though, because the people who published this paper, one is probably the leading neuroscientist at Princeton, Jonathan Cohen. He's the guy who gets the most grant money. He's the director of the Neuroscience Institute. And the other guy, I'm forgetting his name right now, but he just got promoted from assistant to associate professor at Harvard. These guys are in the top commanding positions of the field. They're propagating this view. People are reading it. It's getting picked up by the New York Times. People talk about it. It's all out there and being absorbed by the public without scrutiny. But academics very often will fight against it, but typically there's not a whole lot of will within an academic department to, you know, defend theism.
But he's not dead. I have to confuse with somebody else.
I'm glad he's not dead. I can still send the email. Okay, so here, let me just summarize. I'm really basically done, and I think I need to be done. We talked about this idea of morality and moral responsibility for choice. We pop the hood, we look inside, we see that there's emergent patterns of neural activity. The current view in neuroscience is that we don't have free will, and that's based on what I would say a very limited interpretation of a certain type of experiment. But I think a lot of this is coming out because there's just sort of a blind devotion to reductionism that is totally unwarranted. And it leads people to deny things that are higher order emergent properties that obviously do exist. These are just some of the conclusions, and I think that's it. Thank you for all your questions. I'm willing to take more if you want to stick around. Thanks a lot.
Oh, we've got another 10 minutes, so let's take some
more questions. Oh, okay. Well, let's take more questions. Yeah.
When you said the baby's process, does it take energy?
Oh, you're getting tricky with me. It probably does. It probably does take energy for a person to stand up and sit down. So if it has energy, it must have some mass. Ooh, that's interesting. I don't know. It might be. You'd have to figure out where it comes from. Because each person is deciding whether or not to contribute energy to the wave, right? So I don't know. This is an interesting topic. I'm not sure. Yeah. Tim.
John, there's a passage in Hebrews that talks about so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. And what makes me think of that is the example of, you know, when you rake your yard with bare hands, you'll develop calluses, and by the second or third day you no longer feel it. Is there anything from a neuroscience perspective that's been studied in the brain as far as repetitive things that, you know, you see the brain hardening or, you know, actual physical things happening as a result of, you know, continuous stimulus in an evil area or something along that line?
Yeah, there's lots of study on how repeated activation leads to changes in circuits. But nothing that I know of that has looked explicitly at what you're talking about, which is kind of like, I guess, some sort of dulling of your moral senses.
Dulling the conscience. Yeah.
Yeah, searing of the conscience. I haven't seen anything like that. I mean, actually, this is an area that's totally ripe for discovery. I mean, you can put people in a scanner and you can start to look at things like that. You have to interpret it properly, of course, but I don't know of any studies like that. But what I do know is basically neurons that fire together wire together. This is Hebb's rule, and it largely describes how the brain organizes. So, you know, if you have, like I said earlier, you know, light paired with cheeseburger, light cheeseburger, light cheeseburger, it forms a connection. And we have a vast number of connections when we're first born, and about half of our neurons die. So a huge part of learning is actually pruning the incorrect associations. And then as we're older, we can learn new things by pairing things. But I don't know about this moral question. That would be a neat study to do. There's probably some basis for it, I guess. Yeah.
A little bit off topic, but it's still on the neurons. Just wondering what you think as far as the ability for someone to kind of increase their intellectual potential. I know I've had different professors have different schools of thought on, like, okay, your ability to do physics is like fixed and it's something that's going to decay over time, or it's, I see that it's like a muscle to a certain extent, but obviously you couldn't like take Forrest Gump and teach him like string theory or something like that. So there's kind of these two.
Yeah, I mean, the famous nature nurture thing, I don't know. That's a tough one to come down one way or the other. I mean, I think we're pretty plastic. We can learn a lot of things if we're trained appropriately. But yeah, I would, let's say you take a chimp, no matter how much you train, it will not learn quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
There are some limits. I don't know what those limits are, but yeah. Yeah.
So I'm having a hard time understanding the logic, accepting the results of the study. So if I understand correctly, what they're saying is that there are actions that come before a decision is actually made.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make that then just a random act? I mean, how? You know what I mean?
Could
okay,
it be
if
a
I didn't decide to flip my hand up, if something happened to make that happen before I actually made that decision, and now it's just more of like a physical response to what creates that activity outside of it being a random event.
Right. Well, I should say that they've done studies where they've asked people to do things that are a little bit more thoughtful than just lifting
yeah.
your hand.
Okay.
So, like, you'll play a game and you'll decide to punish an opposing player or not.
Okay.
So they do have things that are a little bit more deliberate than that, but usually they're pretty quick and, you know, rapid. So they would argue that those are fairly realistic, but they're few. Most of the studies are kind of like with little things, like moving your finger and so forth. So I hear your criticism, which is that, you know, how did that hand start to move?
Yeah.
You would say it's the will.
What's the ultimate cause?
They would say that it's just some electrical potential that after the fact informs you that you had a desire. It creates an illusion that you had your desire. Now, to be fair, there's lots of evidence of people confabulating things. Okay, so say for example, I don't know if you've heard about split brain experiments where they cut this superhighway of axons from one hemisphere to the other. It's called the corpus callosum. So there's very limited communication between one half of the brain and the other half. And what they'll do is they'll present people with some sort of task to do, and one hand will do something, but then they'll ask somebody, what did you just do? And the speech center is in the other side from where the hand is. And what people often do is they just make things up that are clearly wrong. They'll make an answer up that sounds reasonable to them, but it's not reasonable. And there's plenty of documentation that people do that all the time. So what these neuroscientists are doing is saying that the idea of free will is much the same thing, is that you do things because of the actions of your neurons, and after the fact, there's some sort of conscious part of you that thought you decided. And really what you're doing is you're just falling in line with whatever your brain told you to do, which is determined by things lower down the chain, motion of molecules.
You get an infinite regress at some point, unless if you're a strict determinist, you get an infinite regress.
Yeah, when do you stop, right? Why not go to quarks? Why not go to things below quarks, if there are such things, right?
I was wrong. We were supposed to end at 12:15.
Okay.
Lunch starts at 12:30.
Yeah, okay. So do I press the button here?
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you after lunch.